Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. We're glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have the opportunity this morning to talk with novelist Rafe Larson, and we'll be talking about his novel, his first novel, The Selected Works of T.S. Spivet. It is published by the Penguin Press and came out a little bit earlier this summer. T.S. Spivet, the character of the title, is a brilliant map maker. Now, while some people might find that his illustrations rise to the level of obsession, I think that T.S. would say that making pictures makes the world easier for him to understand. At the Smithsonian in Washington, the appreciation for his work is so high that they decide to give him an award, and they invite him to come to Washington to give a talk, and he decides to go and get there under his own power. For him, though, that presents something of a challenge because T.S. Spivet is only 12 years old, and this is something that the folks at the Smithsonian do not know. All of this is told in text and in pictures in the book, and I would certainly encourage people to look at it. It's gotten a lot of positive attention so far. Our guest, Rafe Larson, has literally traveled the world talking about the book around the United States. He also was in Europe. He was in Australia. And we're very pleased to have him joining us this morning by telephone to talk about the book. Mr. Larson, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, and I enjoyed the book very much, and I'm glad you could have the opportunity here to talk about it. It is in its form, it's unusual. We'll talk about that. I think the place I'd like to start is to talk about maps, and I think that we have to say we're using a kind of a loose definition here when we talk about T.S. and his mapping. But I think that it is true that he would say, I don't know if he actually says so much in the text, but I think that he would say that that's a way of making the world a more understandable place. Having said all that, how would you define map?
Yeah, that's a difficult question. I mean, I think probably professional cartographers would take issue with, you know, exactly what constitutes a map. But from my point of view, I mean, I'm a storyteller, and I guess I'm interested in, you know, the mechanics of exactly what you said, how we make sense of the world. I mean, I think that's what writers try to do with their characters. And for me, the most interesting thing is how a map shows the kind of internal hopes and fears and desires of the map maker. And that process of kind of transferring the unknown to the known on the paper is a, you know, intensely interesting process. And so that's why I guess I'm less concerned with the technical definition and more interested in, you know, how we map everything around us. And I think definitely T.S., he doesn't just stop at geography. He, you know, he maps handshakes and facial expressions and, you know, basically anything that constitutes the strange world of adults, which he's kind of trying to make sense of.
Yeah. I do think that there's this interesting idea that about the map is that certainly the map will tell you something about the territory that's mapped, but it will also tell you something about the person who made it.
Yes, this is very, I mean, I do this little talk where I show, you know, how maps tell stories. And I think one of the ways they tell stories is through a very kind of selective display of information, because obviously when faced with the task of mapping anything, your neighborhood, you know, the route to your childhood house, whatever it is, you could, in theory, map, you know, an infinite amount of things. But what you choose to include in your little napkin map, or, you know, whether it's a framed thing on the wall, is very indicative of your cultural upbringing, you know, not just the utilitarian, how do you get from A to B, but oftentimes you'll find that you'll include little pieces of your personal geography, like this is, you know, this is the house where my first girlfriend was, and oh, that restaurant, they've got, you know, terrific chicken parm, you know, that kind of thing. And that's, to me, that's the, like, residual pieces of humanity that filter down to these maps, which are really intensely interesting to me.
Yeah. To talk a little bit about the form of the book, I think that and I would encourage people to go out to the bookstore, to the library, wherever they can find the book, and pick it up and start to page through it and look at it. Because what we have here is a main text, which is narrated by T.S. And then in the margins, we have variety of illustrations, his illustrations, maps, other kinds of things, and some text. And what's interesting, I think, is that these two things work together. The main text gives you certain kinds of information. His notes and illustrations give you other things that you would not know if those weren't there. Now, I understand that the way that you wrote the book was that the sort of the main text, you wrote that first.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm a traditionalist in that I believe, you should really try to figure out what your story is and then figure out the best way to tell it, as opposed to kind of putting some kind of formula on it first. So, as I was beginning writing this, I knew that because of this character who was kind of obsessive, as you said, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad word, and digressive, that the book would take on a kind of field guide feel to it. But I really wasn't sure what that would look like. And initially, all of his digressions were in the form of footnotes. But I always struggle with footnotes because I find them authorial and a little bit disruptive. And I'm a slow reader, for one. So when I am forced to interrupt myself on the page in that kind of vertical hiccup, you see the little numeral and you go down to the bottom of the page, it kills this sort of narrative momentum. So at some point in the book, I realized that, that T.S. wouldn't like the form of the footnote. It felt like it was handed to me, and he would actually think of each page almost like a kind of geography or a map. And that's when I discovered this wonderful space of the margins, which then became a kind of playground of his mind. And I migrated the footnotes up to the marginal space, and then had these arrows pointing you to the sidebars. And there's something really, I'm totally seduced by arrows. I love them. There's something, their simplicity, their encouragement for you to follow them. I will follow them, into brick walls. But I think the arrows are almost the key to the book, because it's like I'm taking the hand of the reader and being like, gentle reader, follow me to this marginalia. You'll be safe there. There's a kind of ease with that I think is different than a footnote, what I mean?
Yeah. And I think that, I think that some people perhaps didn't enjoy that, or found that it made it harder to read the book. I guess I would say that in my reading, that it encouraged me to read it in small doses. It was not the kind of thing that I could just sit down and read as sort of a marathon. And I think that that's okay. I think it's nice to take it. I think it's a book that encourages you to take it at a fairly leisurely pace.
Yeah, and I think there's actually also no one way to read it. People have asked me, how should I read this book? And I think that's one of the cool things, is that you kind of figure out, okay, when do I want to enter into these little sidebar territories? You can do that at your own leisure. I mean, I for one am fascinated with how we read, how we process narrative and how we invest ourselves in characters. And so this book has a sort of explosive quality to it, in that there's a lot of different directions going outwards. And you kind of almost watch yourself, or you have to almost teach yourself to read this book in a kind of new way, which is cool, I think.
I don't know that I really thought about it very much when I was reading the book. The illustrations are wonderful, and I guess after having read the book, then going back and reading things about the book, that was when I read that you did the illustrations.
Yeah.
And they're wonderful, and so that impressed me even more, that you were able, in fact, to do both those things.
Yeah, so I got to the end of writing a draft almost completely with just the text, and then I really kind of felt like something was totally missing, and that was when I realized we really actually needed to see his illustrations. I had a couple illustrations in there before, and I had asked a friend to do a couple just stand-in illustrations, and I was thinking about hiring someone, but then I realized I would drive this person crazy with all my minute requests. So I was crossing people off the list who I think could do it, and then the last person on the list was me. And I'm not an illustrator by training. Both my parents are artists, so as growing up, I kind of got the creative process in me by osmosis, I think. But I remember doing that first illustration of the sparrow skeleton on page one, and it was almost like I felt like I was jumping off a cliff, because I was nervous about doing this, but at the same time, it was an incredible way to inhabit the character. And Then the question became, what to illustrate? One could illustrate whatever you want. It's kind of like the conundrum of the map maker. And I really had to be very careful about what I wanted to include. I wanted every bit of marginalia, every image to be doing heavy lifting, to do narrative work. So much so that I found myself deleting text once I included a marginal illustration because the text did it much more elegantly. Like, for instance, the diagram of the dinner table conversation.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Rafe Larson. His book is The Selected Works of T.S. Spivet. Came out in May, and it's published by the Penguin Press. It's a lovely book. I would really encourage people to look at it. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. And I think it seems to be the case, and you know, maybe that it's true with a lot of books, that some people will love it and some people not. And I guess that people would have to look at it and dip into it. And probably they would know, is this a book for them right off? And I suppose you would say, well, if you decide that it is great and if you decide that it's not, well, that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually, the book has sold in 25 countries at this point, which really took me off guard because I think it's a kind of, you know, strange and lovely story about this family in Montana. You know, the father is this classic, laconic cowboy, and the mother is this kind of obsessive, compulsive beetle scientist. And, you know, and T.S. is his own strange little character. Mm-hmm. And so I was really kind of taken aback by the universal appeal of this story in, you know, like Turkey and Romania and Korea, you know, that people really found a kind of nugget of humanity that they could relate to, even though, you know, the book is like peppered with cowboy slang, and it's a very American book. I mean, there's a lot of nods to the Western as a genre. And so that's been interesting to talk to, like, for instance, in Germany, it's going, you know, people are going crazy over it there. And then the more I thought about it, well, I was like, well, Germans love cowboys and diagrams, you know. So I kind of hit them on the most solid fronts, you know. This is like tailor made for the Germans. So, but it's strange as an author, you know, to work on a book that comes from your head in your office for 4 years and then release it into the world and have anyone sort of be like, oh yeah, that rings a couple of my bells too, you know. It renews my faith in our kind of unitedness in some ways, you know.
Yeah. So, you know, that was one of the things I was interested in when I saw that you had on book tour, you had been in Britain, in Holland, in Australia, and I was wondering, well, what it was that people in these other places, people who were not Americans, certainly, what it was that they saw in this book and why they got so excited about it.
Well, I mean, I think you'd have to ask them, but I think, you know, from my conversations, the Western as a genre has been incredibly popular, as you probably know, in, you know, Italy and Japan and Germany and all over the world. I was listening to, I believe it was Radiolab on NPR, talking about how Dolly Parton can fill, you know, stadiums in Zimbabwe. And that there's something about the lonesome country howl, you know, that people really relate to, even if they don't speak English. This kind of notion of, you know, I'm a broken person, you know, the grass is greener over the other side. That's a universal narrative. And particularly, I think there's something about this, you know, the image of the lone cowboy going through this kind of blown out, wide open Western landscape that has a universal seduction. I think people, it's flexible enough that people can insert their own hopes and fears and desires. There's a movie that I often think about. People ask me, why Montana? You know, why did you choose Montana if you're from, I'm an East Coast boy, you know. I was born in Boston. I live in Brooklyn now. And I think Montana is a kind of stand-in often. I mean, I've been out to Montana a lot, but it's a stand-in for those who haven't been there for that kind of grass over the green grass over the hills, and there's this movie that I often think about, The Hunt for Red October, in which Sean Connery plays the defecting Russian nuclear submarine captain, and his second in command is played by Sam Neill, and they have this wonderful, very revealing conversation as they're headed to the U.S., in which Sean Connery says, you know,
So what are you going to do when you get to the United States, you know? And Sam Neill, in his best Russian accent, is like, I would like to see Montana. I would like to have a wife and raise rabbits in Montana, you know? And for him, Montana is that you know, place over the hills. And then, of course, he gets shot at the end. He's bleeding on the decks of the submarine. And Sean Connery's cradling his head. And Sam Neill says, you know, I would have liked to have seen Montana, you know? Uh-huh. So this, there's something, you know, even for a defecting Russian submarine captain, there's something that the West holds that I think allows them to fill in their own dreams there.
Yeah. You have now set a new standard for guests that in the future I'm going to look for impressions.
Yeah, please do.
I think that's wonderful. Well, I think this is very interesting. I think for me, one of the great things about being able to do something like this is to read the book and then read more about and talk to the author about how the thing came together. And I was certainly interested to read that at one point you were thinking about having T.S. actually tell this story as an adult looking back. Now, that you abandoned. But the thing that you were really interested in right from the beginning was cowboys. You wanted to write about cowboys, and you really had this idea that you wanted T.S. to be someone who lived on a ranch.
Yeah, you know, this idea came about, I think, I've worked on a number of documentary films. I guess which I'm interested, again, from a storytelling point of view, how do you, you know, tackle a really complicated issue or a place in an hour and 20 minutes on film? You know, what's your toolbox for telling the story? And so I was working on this film about Crawford, Texas, which basically we were interviewing people who lived, you know, in this small town about how they kind of felt about suddenly becoming this political backdrop for you know, George W. Bush, who bought this ranch there in 2000 or 99. And first of all, people were incredibly welcoming to us, you know, almost in a way that New Yorkers never would open their doors to us, of course. And so we were invited to people's homes and heard all these amazing stories. And one of the characters was this incredibly eloquent, fascinating, actual bronc buster. I mean, he broke horses for a living. And there was this one scene that I keep remembering where he was this fresh stallion, you know, who had never had a saddle on him in his life, was being going through the first stages of kind of being broken. And so this guy Ricky had him running around in circles in this pen with a whip over his head just to get him used to being around a person. And then he got a phone call on his mobile, and he picked it out of his pocket. And it's this wonderful light, you know, the sun is setting. He's kind of got this beautiful light in his face. He's got the whip in one hand and the phone in the other, and he's like, you know, I can't talk to you now, partner. I'm breaking her right now, you know. And this kind of wonderful, at that moment I was struck with how he was fulfilling this role as he was aware of what this role was. And I think that's the kind of conundrum of the modern day cowboy, which is that they are aware of the whole nostalgia. They are aware of the tradition, and they kind of embrace that even as they embrace their own profession. And I was just fascinated with why is it that the cowboy keeps coming up again and again, you know? Why is it that we have politicians co-opting the language of cowboys, you know, like dead or alive? And why do we have this kind of ongoing romance when the actual, you know, American cowboy who drove cattle from Texas to Kansas was only around for about 20 years in the 19th century? And so that was, I guess, one of my starting points was, like, what is it about this ranch that becomes this kind of playground of our imagination? And as you said, initially T.S. was a nostalgic drunk in Paris, in a Parisian prison, kind of looking back, and this was like a terrible, like, Annie Proulx story on steroids or something. So I abandoned that and said, no, he's not 57 or drunk, he's 12, and he's still on the ranch, and the central tension is that whereas his father is this kind of intuitive cowboy, you know, who, like, moves through the land with this quiet ease, T.S. is this, you know, obsessed empiricist who can't do anything but diagram the world in its entirety. And that tension became one of the hinges of the book.
Yeah. Our guest is Ralph Larson. His book is The Selected Works of T.S. Spivet. It's a novel. It's his first. It's been out now for a couple of months. Been very well received. It's published by the Penguin Press. You might want to go out and look at it. Our guest studied at Brown University. He taught at Columbia, where he received his MFA in fiction. He's also a filmmaker. He's made documentaries in the United States, in the U.K., and Sub-Saharan Africa. He lives in New York. He's talking with us by telephone. And questions are welcome, 333-9455 and a toll-free 800-222-9455. We haven't really talked. Maybe I should give you the opportunity to talk a little bit more about the character and about the family, because you've put together this very strange little family grouping with some very odd dynamics. And I think a lot of tension there, because the two parents, his mother and father, are very different people, and you wonder how in the world did they get together. He wonders that. Also, he and his father are very different. His father is this very archetypal cowboy, and T.S. isn't. He is probably more like his mother than his father. There is the presence of a brother who we learn early in the book was killed in an accident involving a gun. And that story is given out sort of piece by piece as you go through the book, so that you get a little bit better understanding about what exactly happened. There's a lot of tension between these people that seem like they're orbiting one another and yet somehow never quite make contact.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the writer's main tasks is to know what to leave off the page, you know. And oftentimes I think you're spending 300 pages articulating what is not said. You know, that's kind of the main goal. And the brother, you know, we learn early on has died in this kind of tragic accident, which has sent this family into a weird, silent tailspin. Because in many ways, Leighton, the younger brother, was the prodigal son, the cowboy in training that the father got along with. And so a lot of what T.S. is, I guess, grappling with over the course of the book is the guilt of why wasn't it him, you know, how does he deal with grief, you know? Because I think one of the interesting things about T.S. is that, you know, while he's possesses this kind of extraordinary skill of mapping and spatializing the world, he's very much 12 in many ways. I mean, he lacks this emotional literacy to deal with grief, and, you know, he's still struggling with himself as an agent in the world, you know. And so I was very careful to write his character such that, because I think oftentimes, and you see this in the book, when adults encounter kids who have one or two extraordinary abilities, they make the mistake of thinking that they are actually just small adults and that they can do everything really well. Like, there's a scene toward the end of the book where this scientist is scanning T.S.'s brain in this study about child prodigies, quote unquote, and she asked him to perform this incredibly difficult math problem. And he kind of, you know, incredulous, says, "Lady, I haven't even done algebra yet. You know, I'm not in eighth grade yet." So we almost want to, you know, if the cowboy is an archetypal character, so is the child prodigy. We assign our hopes and dreams to the prodigy, you know, and wonder why we weren't a prodigy or why our kids can't be prodigies. And I think it's a tenuous relationship, because I think there's almost a little bit of satisfaction when we see child geniuses fail, because we think, okay, well, they might know, pi to the 300th digit, but at least I can, you know, successfully grocery shop, and they were never able to do that, or, you know. So I think I was playing with that. There's a lot of these kind of archetypal American figures in there, including in the family. And I guess one of the interesting things about the family is, you know, you often wonder, okay, why do the mother's a scientist, the father's a cowboy, what are they doing together? But I find this in relationships often, in marriages, that these poles pull at each other. You know, the you often wonder, what are they doing together? And yet when you see them in their quiet, personal moments, you see, there's a reason the magnetism is there. And I think, you know, even on a larger scale, the mother and the father represent two forces at work in the West, which was, on one hand, you had these kind of ranchers steeped in mythology, steeped in this kind of intuitive understanding of the land. And then, particularly in the 19th century, you had these whole troops of zoologists and cartographers and scientists whose kind of sole task was to go out and map the West in its entirety. I mean, the U.S. was staring at this huge territory that they had no idea what was out there, and there was this kind of urge and romantic sense that if we map everything, if we name everything, we'll know everything, you know, which is this wonderfully naive. I love that impulse in us. So it's almost like the mother and the father are standing in for two larger cultural forces at work.
Yeah. Well, I was going to observe that another kind of archetypal character is the natural scientist in the mold of this person that we see in the really in the maybe the 17th and the 18th centuries. And that the mother, who T.S. interestingly enough calls Dr. Claire, he doesn't call her mom. she is like that. And then also as part of the book, there's some family history that goes back some way that truly is that it does come out of that time.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the really interesting things in the book, the relationship between T.S. and the mother, because you would think that they are kind of on the same side or at least in the same discipline. But I think they're kind of there's a fundamental difference there in that the mother, in some ways, represents what modern science has become, which is a sort of hyper specialization. I mean, she's obsessed with finding this singular species of beetle to the detriment of the rest of her work, almost. Which isn't to say that modern science is, you know, going nowhere, but there is this kind of hyper specialization that you see where you no longer have the kind of amateur Renaissance scientist that. In some ways, I think T.S. is, which is why when you read his character, you feel like it's a little bit of a throwback. You aren't quite sure where in space and time T.S. is. And as you said, there's this kind of story within the story that T.S. discovers about his ancestors, and particularly his great-great-grandmother, who was like the first female geologist in the U.S. And there's a lot of kind of similarities between T.S. and this and his ancestor there. So that's interesting that you have these two strains of science. On one hand, you know, as we become more and more advanced, we demand this kind of specialization, and we've lost that sense of the wandering scientist who dabbles in zoology and cosmology and botany and knows a little bit about everything, which I think I kind of like that 19th century amateur. I think we could do more with more of them.
We have a caller, and certainly others could join on the conversation. Let me just, again, very quickly introduce our guest. We're talking with Rafe Larson. He is the author of a recently published novel, his first, The Selected Works of T.S. Spivet. It's published by the Penguin Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Someone in Gibson City here, line number one.
Yes, hello.
Hello, yes.
Yes, I just want to say I'm really looking forward to reading your book. And I wonder if part of the popularity for it is because it is different and not, I don't know if I want to say Hollywood-ish, but there's a mentality in other countries of what with our TV and movies. When my daughter was in college, she had a roommate from Honduras, and actually the roommate was kind of concerned about her, about, you know, the image of the college or young adult woman, so the image that was portrayed. And I wonder if that's one of the popularities of your book. And listening to what you're saying about the book, and I just want to say in real life, I think opposite people attract. And sometimes what you're attracted to as you get married could be the same thing that causes problems. I'll just hang up and listen. And like I said, I'm really looking forward to reading your book.
All right. Well, thank you for the call.
I mean, you know, one of the interesting things about being a writer is, at least for me, you have to kind of throw things down on the page and then see how they stand. You know, I know certain writers kind of plan out their entire book before they even write a word, but. Like I used to do comedy improv in college, and I find that I write almost like I improv, and that I have to leave that room to be surprised on the page. So certainly, when I was writing these characters, I didn't set off to be like, you know, I want to create a relationship where there's these two opposite characters. It was more like the characters form themselves, and then I had to kind of see how they were attracting and repelling each other. I think that's the interesting thing about writing is you throw paint down on the canvas and you kind of have to see what this, you know, and if the world that you're creating is organic and real, you're going to stumble into these things that surprise you. Like, for instance, I don't want to give anything away, but in the middle of the book, T.S. finds himself in Chicago and actually performs a pretty horrific deed, which when it happened, I was totally shocked, you know. which is amazing that we have this capacity to write something down from about a character that we've totally created and yet be surprised by the agency of this character. And I walked around my house like a zombie for 2 days, and you know, my girlfriend was like, what's going on? And I was like, I can't believe that happened. And I think that maybe that's a sign of a healthy character, in that he can surprise you with his actions, and then you have to say, is this character capable of that? And I think I decided, yeah, he was.
Mm. You know, I think it's also the caller talked about how sometimes people who have very opposite personalities do come together, and that could be good initially, and maybe that it can cause problems. I think also part of the story has to do with parents and children, and about how either you can look at your child and say, that is absolutely my child, or you can look at your child and say, where exactly did you come from?
Yeah, and I think that you, by the end of the book, you kind of come to an understanding of how the parents feel about the kids, you know. But what's also interesting, I have a younger brother who's very different than I am, you know. And I mean, both my parents were artists, and you know, so I grew up in a world where I thought everyone was an artist. And in fact, I was over at my friend's house when I was pretty young, and his, you know, father left for work in the morning. And I was afraid that he had left forever. I didn't have this conception of like a 9-to-5 job, you know. And they said, no, he'll be back in about 8 hours, you know, no need to worry. And my younger brother, in contrast, when he was like 4 years old, I said, oh, are you going to be an artist? And he said, oh, no, there's no money in the arts. Mm-hmm. You know, I was totally shocked. I was like, where did he get this concept? And I was like, well, what are you going to do? And he said, oh, I'm going to go into medicine. And I was like, oh, really? And he's like, yeah, and I'm going to own a toilet factory. And I was like, you know, what? A toilet factory? And very calmly, you know, this is a 4-year-old kid. He said, everyone needs a toilet, you know. So he had this kind of, you know, intuitive sense of bread products already, you know. He had more economic sense than I ever had. So it's very strange how we came out of the same environment and yet, you know, totally went in separate directions, which I always kind of, you know, come down on that there's a certain kind of element to nature that you can never quite, you know, turn away, which keeps things interesting, I think.
I thought that I read, you tell me if it's true, did not your own parents say to you, don't be an artist, there's no money in that?
Yeah. And I asked them, you know, why are you artists? And they kind of said, well, you know, we can't do anything else, really. There was a sort of elemental pull. And so I steer clear to, you know, before illustrating this book, I steer clear of the visual arts, but I know what they are saying, and that I feel at peace when I'm struggling and writing a story. Like, that's when I feel like, you know, when athletes talk about being in the zone or whatever it is, like when I am, you know, laying down fresh type on a page, then I feel like whole, you know. It's interesting that you know, everyone has their thing, whatever it is, whether it's, you know, painting model cars or working in the garden or, you know, colliding atoms together in Switzerland. It's like whatever that thing is that gives you that buzz in your veins, you know, find it and then do it for as long as you can, you know. So
one of the things that I wanted to ask you about was how it is that people have looked at the book and thought about the book and who they thought it was for. And I guess it's sort of my understanding that some people picking up the book and looking at it and seeing that it had pictures thought, oh, well, this has pictures. This is a book for children. And I did, in fact, read an interview you did maybe about a month ago where you said that the publisher actually was starting to market this as a book for young adults. So that makes me wonder, particularly here in the United States, whether you think that somehow the book has had a difficult time finding its audience, or that people have looked at it and particularly because of the illustrations, have gotten an idea about the book that it's just not true.
No, I don't think there's, I mean, I certainly wrote it for adults, you know. I mean, one of the things I think people said was, oh, you know, this is about a 12-year-old. It must be for kids, you know, which to me, I mean, I can see where they're coming from, but you know, I think this is a book as much about how adults react to kids as kids, but also that we were, you know, the notion that a book about a kid can't be for adults seems crazy to me, because we were all once kids, a lot of us have kids, you know, we spend thousands of dollars in therapy trying to deal with our childhood. You know, that the notion of growing up is looms large in our lives all the time, you know. But I think this book has done very well with adults, but I think publishers see this as a crossover book, you know, in that it can be read by a wide range of people. And I think that that's true. I mean, I definitely my who I was thinking about was me, was my target audience, you know, because you're kind of in your darkest depths of writing over the course of the 4 years. I was the only person around for most of it. So I was like, is this interesting? And I was like, yeah, you know, so, but I think I've gotten a lot of feedback from younger people that have really responded well to the book, you know, that they've some of the, you know, growing pains of that you've talked about, you know, can adults negotiate the multiple texts going on? For kids growing up, this is no problem. You know, they're kind of inundated with overlapping texts and hypertext fiction and all kinds of stuff like that. So it's almost like this is how a 12-year-old's brain works, you know, is that kind of swirling, digressive pattern of let me tell you a little bit more about this. But I think this book can be read, you know, but basically by anyone from age 11 to 95, you know. And certainly younger people will get a different thing out of it. I mean, there's some tough four parts of this and advanced language, but I don't want to, you know, tell anyone to not read it.
Yeah. Our guest is Rafe Larson. He is the author of the recently published novel, The Selected Works of T.S. Spivet. It is published by the Penguin Press. I'm sure you can find it now in the bookstore, perhaps in the library. You want to look at it. And I would certainly suggest that you do. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. There was, you know, one of the reviews I read of the book had this criticism. They said something like, well, there's not a lot of story here. And you might want to take issue with that particular criticism, but my reaction to that was, well, that kind of misses the point. To me, I think this book is very much a character study. It's about this very unusual character, how the world looks to him and how he encounters it, and also what happens to him and how his character changes over the course of the book.
I think you could probably say a lot of things about the book, but I guess I'm a little bit flummoxed at the notion of that there's no story here. Because I come from I went to the MFA school, and oftentimes, you know, plot is like a four-letter word there, you know. Like, you'll read a lot of stories, and it's like two people sitting in a room and, like, kind of staring at each other and arguing, you know.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, it's that kind of nothing happens. But I think this book, you know, is like a plot bonanza. You know, it's like there's a journey, there's death, there's war, there's, you know, stories within stories. I mean, I think one could almost say that there's too much story, you know, because I guess, again, going back, I'm a traditionalist in that, you know, I think writing should be, you know, crisp and powerful and clear and evocative and all those things, but in order to really get your readers to care, you need to craft, you know, fully nuanced characters and hook them with some of the ingredients of suspense, you know. Like, one of my favorite authors of all time is Raymond Chandler, like the master detective novelist, because he knew how to hook a reader and never, like, let him go, you know. And I think some of the more literary writers are afraid of, you know, including too much suspense or, you know, using some of those devices because they'll be seen as, you know, sellouts or populists. But, you know, I think there's a reason why we take joy in stories, you know, and it's for the author to give us a little bit of information, but not to give us the whole story and keep us stringing along. We take delight in that as readers. So I think I was also, you know, aware of how Westerns and classic road journeys stories do that. So I wanted this to be, you know, a fun read. I mean, I think it's, I'm on the reader's side, I should say. I think some writers, you know, they throw a lot at you, but I wanted the reader to really enjoy this book as they work their way through it.
Well, I certainly think it is true that if you approach this from the point of view of the character and about the challenge that he takes on, because early on what happens is that the Smithsonian calls, and they say, we have awarded you this prestigious award, and as part of this, we'd like to have you come and give a talk. Now, and the man who is calling from the Smithsonian has no idea that T.S. is 12. And T.S., he's not really quite sure how to respond, but he doesn't say, "Well, sir, that's very nice, but I'm only 12 years old." His immediate impulse is to say, "Well, I'm sorry, I can't, and thank you very much," and he hangs up. Then, given more thought, he says, "Well, no, I'm going to go." But then he makes this decision that he's going to go, and he's going to go on his own. And then the journey unfolds. So if you look at the challenge that he's taken on, what happens to him over the course of it, how that affects the dynamic within the family, I think that you would have to say an awful lot happens in terms of the character in his world between the beginning and the end.
Yeah. And, you know, I like a lot of people, I'm seduced by the open road, you know, or in this case, the open railroad track, you know, that there's something, you know, again, if we're talking about archetypes, the hobo is, there's something so delightful about, you know, just heading out and not sharing where you're going, you know. And I could read road journeys all day long, you know, and I love driving across the country. I think I've driven across the country like 6 times. And there's something, again, if we go back to kind of universal narrative, there's something that we all kind of delight in about that, you know. So, you know, any book that where a journey is impending, where you don't know what's going to happen and you're not even sure the other people on the other end want to see this person, you know, I think has that kind of element of suspense that makes you want to keep turning the page.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to write a book that I would want to read, you know.
We have about 6-7 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is novelist Ralph Larson. His new book is The Selected Works of T.S. Spivet, out now, published by Penguin Press. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, someone would like to call in. I was interested also to learn that at one point that you had an afterword that had been, that you had written, that's in the voice of another character, a character in the book, who is, in a sense, commenting on the story that you have presented on T.S., maybe adding additional sorts of information that fleshes out the character and the family and the whole story. But then you decided not to include that in the book. Now, it's also my understanding that that on the website for the book, either that's there, that material is there, or it's going to be there as part of the website, which is very nice, by the way. I hope people will look at the website too. Maybe you can talk about how it is you wrote that and then decided, no, I'm not going to include that in the book.
Yeah, that was one of the hardest things, challenges for me was this whole afterword kind of answered a lot of the questions that I'm sure a reader will have at the end. And, you know, as a writer, you kind of want to give the answers, you know, because you're like, you know, I know them, here they are. But I think I ultimately decided to cut it because I don't know about you, but I feel like the, you know, the hours and the days and the weeks after you finished a kind of book that's subsumed you, when you're trying to figure out what happened and how you square yourself with it and your own world with it, that is like the richest time of reading almost. You know, you kind of have that post-book buzz about you. And I didn't want to cut that short by cutting off any avenues. And so the ending you'll see is a little bit voluminous, and there's kind of multiple ways to interpret what happened. And I wanted people to kind of argue about that a little bit. And I was in Australia, and my God, all these book clubs down there, you know, they were ferociously disagreeing with each other, and they asked me all these questions about what happened, and, you know, they had all these interpretations. And to me, that made me realize it was the right decision, because that kind of, you know, arguing about literature and what happened, it's such a great it's such a great aspect of humanity, you know, that we can argue about stories and really get into these things. It's one of my favorite parts about human beings, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So as a compromise, because I knew there would be people out there who wanted the kind of story within the story and, like, the extra bits, I migrated it to the website, which I think is, you know, as there's this whole larger culture argument about whether books are dying, I think books will be around for a long time. I mean, I think they are like a genius technology. We love them. You know, we can rewind them at any time. We can, you know, there's no late fees. They fit in our laps. There's something great about them. But at the same time, we are in a society where media and the way that we get media is changing, you know, and particularly stuff is migrating online. So one of the things I wanted to do with this book, and I think it's a book that's particularly suited for it, is explore the ways that a novel, the evocative space of a novel, can have a dialogue with its website, and how you can kind of create a whole other world on a website. So I thank you for mentioning the website. It's tsspivot.com. And I spent a lot of time working with a web designer, and we kind of design it like this cabinet of wonders, of curiosities, where you can click on each panel and you kind of go into the world of that character. So there's a panel about the father and the panel about the West. And I want to use the tools that websites do well to kind of augment and frame the book in a new way. And what I did was I chopped up the afterword and kind of hid it. So if you get bored, you can kind of become a detective and find all these little pieces of this afterword written in one of the characters' voices.
Well, it's certainly true that the technology of the ebook now is not up to the selected works of T.S. Spivot. you can't do that as a Kindle. But I was very interested in, and actually I think I read this before, having looked at the website in one interview, that you said that you thought this was an exploded hypertext book. And yeah. I thought, well, yeah. And in fact, the web technology is up to doing this. And that's, in a way, I think, what the website does, although you could do that and you could more fully integrate the text with illustrations and the marginalia and lots of other stuff so that you could jump around any way that you liked. You could do that with the computer. You can't do that with a Kindle. Not yet, at least, you can't.
Yeah, but I've thought a lot about this because I've been suspicious of hypertext, and I think that there's something about the act of explosion and then cementing it on paper, which is much different than reading this book online, for instance, because there's something about the collapse that web devices do where you don't see the other parts are hidden that makes it somehow more sterile. I mean, I think there's something about seeing all these arrows on the page that is sort of almost, for me, emotional. Like, it's like a map, you know, and I think one of the reasons I love maps is that I keep searching for that perfect map that shows everything, you know, that captures a town in its entirety or captures a world in its entirety. And of course, there will never be such a thing. You know, we are limited to only mapping out what we can map, you know. And I think seeing the connections that are made in this book and not seeing the rest of the connections and seeing them laid out is a way of seeing the mortality of our characters, you know, and the flawed nature of T.S., you know, how he makes all these connections that may be right and maybe not right. And so I guess I'm still, for me, the jury is still out about how to actually mimic a novel like this online, but I think there's a lot of room for exploration there.
We're just about at the point we have to finish. I hope you forgive me for raising this issue, but I wanted to ask you because it seems like almost everything I read about the book, and there was a lot written about the book, and there were a lot of reviews, mentioned the fact that the publisher paid a lot of money for the book, and I'm sure that you were happy about that, and other first-time novelists probably tearing out their hair when they read that. I guess I wonder what you make of that, and did it annoy you that aspect was getting so much attention?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, as a first-time novelist, you want the attention on the story, on the book, you know, because all that stuff is, you know, out of my control. I mean, I'm just the author, and you know, I just wrote my strange little story and was shocked that anyone wanted to pay any money for it. You know, I think as a writer, if you are serious about it and spend enough time, you've long ago, you know, kind of sworn off any sort of success because it's just, you know, it's becoming more and more difficult, you know. And so for me, my expectations were so low, and, you know, I wanted a place to see this strange little book for what it was and make it into a kind of beautiful book, which I think Penguin Press did a really beautiful job, you know. They paired me with an incredible graphic designer who took all my illustrations and flogged them and beat them and made them beautiful. So, you know, I just feel lucky that I get to write another day and write another strange little book. So, you know.
And speaking of strange little books, I have read a lot of strange one- and two-line descriptions of the next book. a radical underground puppeteer is doing plays about particle physics. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's what it's about right now. It may shift, but yeah, it's a much more international book. It kind of goes from Cambodia to Congo to Sarajevo, and so it's very different in that way. And there's no illustrations as of yet. You know, there may be puppet strings popping out of the book, but
well, I know that
that's my publisher.
I know that
she'll kill me.
You've said that you don't want to become known as the guy who writes illustrated books.
Yeah. I think I really believe in, you know, what's your story, and then figuring out how to best tell that. Yeah. You know, whether it's with plain old text or, you know, flamethrowers. You know.
Well, I really want to say to people that they should look at the selected works of T.S. Spivet. It's a very special and unusual book. I think it's not like probably anything else that you have read. By our guest, Reif Larsen. His first name, by the way, spelled R-E-I-F. The book is published by the Penguin Press. It's out now. And Mr. Larsen, thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, the real pleasure. Thanks for having me.